entitled Holy Space and Holy Time. And we'll look at these two subjects one after another. That's how they come in this chapter, Holy Space and Holy Time. And Dr. Sproul begins by describing how, I'm just going to get a book here to keep this propped up, how our own generation feels so much trapped in the here and now. Like when you talk to most people in our own day and age, especially younger people, it's just this world, this time. Outside this world, eternity doesn't really come into their thinking, doesn't come into the equation. There's no concept of the heavenly or of the transcendent of what is above this earth. And for some, that's okay. For a lot, though, there's a sense of loss, that there's some unbridgeable chasm here, that there is a dimension out there, but we are here, that's there, and never the two shall meet. And that's why he goes on to speak of deism, D-E-I-S-M, which is really Godism, but it was used to really describe a heresy in the 1800s, although it's been around for a longer time. And the idea is of God as a divine clockmaker. So God makes the clock, God winds up the clock, and God leaves the clock to run and walks away. And he never comes and, you know, moves the hands. He doesn't wind it up again. He doesn't intervene again. He just lets it go. The clock stands on itself, operates itself. And that this is an illustration of how many people view God's relationship to this world. They might see him as a creator, as somebody who's designed and made this world, but has walked away from it. Again, there's no connection between God up there and us down here. There's this unbridgeable chasm. So we're left again on our own. God is aloof and apart. We are here, lonely and independent of God. That's deism. And although it was actually very popular at a time, and indeed at an influential time in America's history, when the Constitution was being drawn up, the impact of it was that people see all the events of this world, the causes and the effects, as all just contained within this world. It's got nothing to do with God. So God is watching, perhaps, but not involved. And that's not true for people just on the cosmic level in terms of how this world is running, but on the personal level also. And so religion is viewed as a sort of personal therapy for people who have difficulty coping with difficulties. It's not a way of meeting with God. And so, as R.C. Sproul puts it, ours is a profane existence with no sense of the presence of the holy. Although, he says, people have always looked for a window or a door to the transcendent, to the sacred. And the result is that although people may feel that they don't have religion, they don't want religion, God's way up here, we're down here, we can't connect, yet still human beings engage in religious behavior. So then he goes on to show how this view of the world, this view, this deistic view, this separated view, this God at a distance view, is not accurate, it's not truthful, it doesn't match what the Bible tells us about God and his relationship to this world. And so he gives us a number of examples focused mainly on three areas: Moses in the burning bush, Jacob at Bethel, and Noah at the time of the flood. So just briefly looking at these three, Moses in the burning bush. So here Moses experiences a threshold to holy space. He's standing here in this ground and he's fine. The bush starts burning, God is present, he starts moving towards it, and God says, stop, the ground you're walking on is holy ground. So there was a threshold, there was a point at which, a line in the desert sand, as it were, where Moses went from standing on profane ground to standing on sacred ground, from being on a space and an area that was unholy to a space that was holy. And what Dr. Sproul says is that holy space wasn't holy in and of itself. It wasn't holy apart from God making it holy with his presence. And then Jacob at Bethel, you had the same thing. The ground he was on was just ordinary, profane, non-sacred ground. But this ladder appears with the angels up and down, linking sacred heaven with this profane earth and turning it again into a portal, a window into the presence of God, or as it was called, the house of God. That's what Jacob called this place after this experience. And the stone that he slept on, again, it wasn't an intrinsically holy stone. It had just been an ordinary stone in the desert, but because it had become such a special place, it was where he saw this vision. It was separated and it became holy. He anointed it. He poured oil upon it. It became a sacred mark of this sacred space. So again, you've got ground that has changed because it became a threshold, a window, a door connecting the holy and the unholy. And then the same thing happens with Noah. After the flood, he comes out, he builds an altar to make an offering, to pour oil upon it and mark the spot of a new beginning from destruction to redemption. And then Dr. Sproul highlights a number of other incidents where Abraham, Isaac and Moses built altars, and each one of them and all of them are marking this, again, moving something from a profane, unholy or non-holy item to become holy and sacred. And so then he comes more into our own lives with our own churches. So, okay, we have desert, we have stones, we have areas, we have altars that move from being ordinary, secular, profane, to holy. Is that true of churches, of church buildings? Well, he argues very strongly that it does, that churches are holy spaces because they involve a meeting with a holy God. They become thresholds, they become doorways, portals into the transcendent, or that brings the transcendent down into our lives. And so church sanctuaries should be viewed as holy spaces. That traditionally, historically, churches were built to serve as a sacred space reserved as a place to encounter the holy. And Dr. Sproul is very, very, very strong on this. I don't know if you read him or hear him. He's always talking about the importance of church architecture and the message, the non-verbal message that it sends. And so, for example, he's very critical of, you might call storefront churches or mall-type churches or theatre-type churches, where, you know, there's a real attempt made to just make church like every other place. And, you know, so you get mega churches, which are really just like sports stadia or like indoor auditoriums, or you get, you know, mall space made into churches. And the whole idea is to just make it feel like everyday life. So everyone can relax and be chatty, and there might be a stage where we watch what's going on, and You know, we have our Starbucks and we can chat and discuss, and it's just like everyday life. And this is, you know, very persuasively proposed as the way to get people into church and to keep people into church, in church. But Dr. Sproul says this is all sending a message about God as well, and that it's emphasizing too much his imminence, his nearness, his down-to-earthness, but doesn't take account of his transcendence. It's no longer a sacred space. So he says you take these Gothic cathedrals with their high ceilings, vaulted spaces, towers, spires. He was saying these were all designed to focus on God's transcendence. It was to lift up and to make people think of what is high and lifted up, rather than the sort of fellowship facility, town hall type of facility that many churches have now become. And he's saying that what these functional church designs have lost is this profound sense of threshold. And he told it, I found a fascinating story in the chapter of the teenage girl, I think she was 14 or something, who they were touring Europe, friends of his, and they walked into this, you know, one of these huge European ancient cathedrals, and like as they watched her, the teenage sort of, you know, loudness disappeared and she was silenced and quiet, and then they noticed she was even almost like tiptoeing around this huge cathedral, and then that she sat down in the pew and she's just like in awe of this place, and she started walking around, and then she came back to her parents and said, is it okay if I go over there? And you know, she had some sense of there was, I don't know, just difference and something special. And Dr. Sproul was saying, you know, this is vital for churches to have this, a place that signals a transition from ordinary life to what is sacred, to what is holy, from the earthly life to the heavenly realm, as it were. And so he points to how in the past, it's not done so much now, but when churches were built, they were consecrated, they were set apart for the special purpose of encountering God. And he points to like places you were converted or had special spiritual experiences, or he talks about his experience of, say, visiting the Holy Land. This, again, the sense of a special place because God's presence had been there. So it'd be worth coming back to that and discuss it. Maybe John especially wants to pipe in there. So I'll run through this next one. Holy time. This is a wee bit more complex. He distinguishes two biblical words for time. One is chronos, which is just the ordinary passing of time, like what time is it? And then there's kairos, which were special moments of redemptive significance, something like a historic event. And these kairos times take place within chronos time. It's not as if these special events are taking place in mythology, outside time and space. They take place within ordinary, moment-by-moment passing of time. But these kairotic events, these momentous historic events, are moments like the creation or the fall, the exodus, the captivity, the incarnation, the cross, the resurrection. And he's saying these were marked in the Bible as holy moments or holy periods. And from that, he argues that we should continue to set apart holy days. We should have these times in our church calendar, Christian life, where we set apart specific time for holy purposes. So, you know, obviously the Lord's Day is one of these. We remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. We have communion times, of course, and other Christian celebrations. He points to the Lord's Day, the Sabbath, which commemorates God's work of creation, which celebrates God's work of redemption, being a rest for the people of God, and celebrates the future promise of rest in heaven. And similarly, he looks at the Lord's Supper as a time that looks to the past and remembers, that celebrates the present salvation, and that looks to the future for the banquet feast of the Lamb. And so he's saying, look, everybody tries to break up time and have special times, celebratory times, remembrance times, anticipatory times. Even profane people do this. But church should do it as well, that we should mark specific times in church life, in Christian life, that will remind us of the transcendent, of the holy. And so he concludes, in sacred space and sacred time, Christians find the presence of the holy. The bars that seek to shut out the transcendent are shattered, and the present time becomes defined by the intrusion of the holy. Of course, the whole book is about how do we encounter the holiness of God. That's his anxiety. It's not just to be an academic study of God's holiness, but how do we get it? How do we reach it? How does it come into our lives? And he's really suggesting, by way of application in this last chapter, here are two ways. It's by having holy places and by having holy times, that these are two God-ordained ways for us to encounter and experience the holiness of God, like R.C. Sproul did, like the Apostle John did, like Isaiah did, like the disciples did, and so on. The holiness of God. Well, I do hope that it has created at least a hunger for this in our lives. If not, I hope also, at least from time to time, an experience of this, that this is something desirable, this is something enjoyable, and this is something profitable to have in our lives.